Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 17. Thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Scroobius Pip. You can hit me up on Twitter at Scroobius Pip. Yo, why you'd want to do that, I do not know. I don't know why I've mentioned that so early. I've not given you any reason to want to hit me up at this point, other than if you wish to argue about the name of the podcast, which isn't up for debate. Don't know what I'm talking about. This week's guest is Kate Tempest. A lot of you have requested this one. She's had an amazing 12 months and has been blowing up. It's the oldest friend I've had on the podcast. I've known Kate for a long while now, so it was really great to get to sit down and chat with her. I'd imagine have high hopes, as you've all been requesting this one, and she's a great talker and we have a great discussion. So really looking forward to hearing this. But before that, I should do the sponsors that keep this podcast free. One being Speech Development Records. That's my record label. If you go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com or scroobiuspip.co.uk, you can support the podcast by going and buying things from the web store. We've got t-shirts, we've got mugs, we've got hats, we've got jackets, we've got a lot of CDs and DVDs as well. So there's a lot of things on there. There's digital downloads, all sorts. You can get my Edinburgh Fringe show for just £5 digital download. Five star reviews, 19 shows sold out in a row. So yeah, check that out. Speech Development Records. Yeah. We're also brought to you by Onnit.com. Onnit is a human optimization website that has a lot of weight training stuff and fitness stuff. It annoys me because obviously with them sponsoring the show, I'd use the 10% discount that you guys can get by going to onnit.com/scroobiuspip. That's onnit.com/scroobiuspip. I'd use it to buy some of their weight stuff, but in the UK, obviously, it's expensive to ship that stuff. But they've got these amazing kettlebells, the primal bells. They've got monkeys on, which sounds ridiculous, but they've got monkeys. They've got monkeys carved into them, and they're kind of made and balanced, so it doesn't affect in any negative way. So you can still get a good workout out of them. But they also do stuff for the brain and for your general well-being. So check them out, and as said, you get 10% discount just for listening to this show by going to onnit.com/scroobiuspip. I forgot my name for a second there. The third and final way for you to support the podcast is to subscribe. It really means a lot and makes a difference. It's a free way for you to help us. I'll explain this. Basically, if you subscribe and have it download the new episode each week, then it basically helps our chart position, helps our download numbers, and makes us more appealing to advertisers that take on your role of paying for this, if that makes sense. I'd rather the reason we have sponsors is so that I can make it free to you guys. I'd rather some big company's advertising budget pays and you keep your money in your pocket, or spend it on sweets or whatever you fancy spending it on. So yeah, please subscribe on Acast or iTunes or anywhere you fancy subscribing, or simply at distractionpiecespodcast.com. That's enough of the intro, really, isn't it? Yeah, Kate Tempest, amazing spoken word artist and rapper and MC and poet and writer in general. We had a great chat. I'm looking forward to you hearing it. I'll be back at the end with information of next week's show and just some more stuff to tell you. So, see you in a bit. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. We're good. Well, in that case, we've begun. I'm here with Kate Tempest. How are you doing, Kate?
I'm really good, Pip. Nice to see you.
It's lovely to see you, and I'm really pleased with this scenario. Because yeah, we're normally either at a gig or like at the radio show or things like that at the studios.
Yeah.
And this is nice because you're off writing in Whitstable. Am I allowed to reveal your location?
I think I'll bleep that out. I think it'll be all right.
And it's lovely. It's a nice, quiet little Seaside Town. How are you finding a Whitstable? You've essentially gone from album coming out, everyone going mental, touring, Mercury nomination, more mentalness, more touring, to Whitstable.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful. Yeah. I think that's a wonderful kind of scope.
It feels nice. It feels like everything did go pretty mental. We were on the road for ages and it was great. We were touring loads of very kind of public stuff, you know, gigging and press and that. And so I've got this novel I've got to finish. And so I'm just here with my dog and, like, this is maybe the first human contact I've actually had in about 2 weeks. It's good.
It's good though, right? You're feeling...
I feel lovely. It's
good,
like,
from it. It's an amazing kind of thing. People get, particularly living in London and coming from London, there's the constant urge to surround yourself with people constantly. And that's not necessarily always the best situation for creativity or even just for your mental health, I don't think. I think you need a balance of the two, personally. That could be because I'm a boring, a recluse who sits at home in my flat all the time and I'm justifying it. But I don't know. I think for ideas to develop and grow, whether it be creative or actual personality or personal things, you need a bit of space,
right? I think it's
right?
When I'm at home, when I'm in London, it's just there's so much distraction, which is brilliant. Like, you know, I've got all my mates there, and there's like loads to see and do, and you want to. There's like the studios down the road, and all that stuff. And I just got this thing I need to do. I just wanted to just be somewhere where I know I'm not just going to just get up and go out, or you know, get stuck into going to see a band or whatever. So I've just been, it's feeling really good. I'm like, I've got another week to go and then it's back out on tour, and then it's like I was saying to you, then it's like 6 months or something of quite intense touring. So I'm just getting ready for that as well, getting ready to just not be knackered and give it my all and all that kind of stuff.
That's wicked. I said I really like the, I love it as an idea, particularly at that point where a lot of people would be going, man, that's been a hell of a year. Do you know what I mean? On the top, on the kind of potentially going off the rails a little bit you know. And the beauty of it is you've gone from kind of, I guess, having to be on guard or on show all the time because of how the Mercury stuff went as well. And we will go into more detail on all of this. But that's... I'm not going to keep going on about this, but have you felt there's been that ability to just let your guard down and just be you, not be Kate Tempest?
Yeah, man.
Oh, what do you think of the Mercury nomination? What do you think of the album? What do you think of the tour and all this? Just go, right, I'm just... Essentially, I'm here to keep this dog alive.
Yes, nice. Yeah. Like, I'm just like,
this is my main thing. I'm writing as well, but I'm mainly the companion of this.
It's lovely.
This animal.
I'm having a lot of dog
hasn't
chat.
Hasn't got a clue that I've got a Mercury nomination.
He does not care. I'm going down the beach and walking around and, like, do you know what I mean? Talking to people about what what their dog likes to eat. You know, I don't know if anyone's a dog owner, but you do get into these quite intense, brilliant dog chat conversations while your dogs are playing. Anyway, that's maybe not the most rock and roll kind of thing to reveal that I've been up to.
I mean, also, I'm going to use a line that I worked in HMV for years, and I had a manager called Tim, who I really liked, who was a Welsh lad, and he'd got a new dog, and it's the same breed as yours.
Wicked.
And he came in one day and just went, Pip, look at this. He's like, I've just got a wolf in my house.
Yeah,
it's the most amazing thing. And he is.
Yeah.
What kind of dog is... What is the...
He's a husky Malamute cross.
And it's just a wolf strolling about your house. It's the best thing in the world.
It's amazing. It's lovely. And like when he's... Like when we go out, there's a woodland up the road, and like watching him, he's like hunting for, like, you know, hunting the rabbits and the squirrels. Yeah. He's never caught one, but like just watching that, it's so like... It's so amazing to just watch him. Like all his instincts are just like... bang on, like his ears are up, he's like stalking, jumping, all the stuff, and it's like it's pure joy when you're hanging out with, I mean, whatever, like I love my dog, but it's just so nice to just get away from, like you're saying, interviews and all that kind of, well, here's an interview, but it's a bit different because we know each other, but like to just be somewhere where none of that matters, and just it's beautiful, like the sea, you can just see for miles, you know, it's like, and the sea, like no matter how big an idea is, the idea I'm working on just keeps getting bigger and bigger. You start going mental with that. You go outside, you look at the sea, that's bigger than any idea you could ever have. So you're just like, all right, okay, fine. Do you know what I mean? When you're looking at something that big, the sky, the sea, the beach, you're just like, puts you back in touch with like all of this stuff just being it's a labour of love, you know, it doesn't have to be a struggle. This is a really amazing job to have. Yeah. And, like, I think when you're, like, right in it, it can get a bit, gets, you know, you just get a bit tunnel vision, get a bit lost.
It can get completely warped. I remember, I'm going to name drop now, but I remember with two people, with Adele and with Kate Nash, I remember when their first albums were coming out, and Jack Opinion, it became a theme because I think they all, I gigged with a lot of them, but they all had their albums out before me. And it's that weird thing of when you're in the middle of it, it's hard to see how amazing it all is. You suddenly become focused on, right, is it, what are the sales? Are we in the chart? Where are we in the chart? Or what are the ticket sales like? Or are we going to win this or win that? And on all of them, on the day of their album, I kind of have a thing of hitting them up, just saying, just take a second in the midst, particularly with all of them, that all were looking for number one albums.
Yeah, that's a bit of a different league, isn't it?
But still, just email them saying, look, just how cool is it that you've got an album in a record shop?
Yeah.
If you go in a record shop, your name is got its own little card. Like someone's had to make that little headerboard, and it's you.
Yeah.
And how amazing is that? And I think that's why stepping away from things is absolutely key. I've always had a thing on New Year's Eve. It's my favourite night of the year, and all my mates will never ever get their heads around it because they'll think I hate it, but I stay in on New Year's Eve. And the point of that is exactly that. I spend so much of my life at gigs, in venues, and New Year's Eve is one to go, man, we played a festival in front of thousands of people this year, and we did this and did that, and kind of reflect and take it all back. So it's nice. Can you see yourself moving from city life to more rural?
I don't know if I could. I mean, maybe sometimes you think about it, you think, oh, that would be nice, but actually the reality is I'm a city girl, always have been, and like my home, like South London is changing a lot. That's another thing which is kind of on my mind at the moment, of like your home changes when you're from a city that's constantly growing.
What's going on with Brixton, man?
Well, right, exactly. Do you know what I mean? And I always thought South London would be immune to it.
I'm not sure at all if it's a bad thing. It could be a great thing, but there seems to be so much going on that it's becoming such a cool, hip place. Yeah. And it's the same with parts of East London. It kind of, coming from Essex as a kid and going into London for gigs and things like that.
Yeah.
Brixton was somewhere you look after yourself, you keep an eye on shit. You don't just go there I don't get too drunk at a gig in Brixton.
Because
I've got to get home, and it's Brixton, it's rough. Whereas now it's going so on the art side of things and culture and all that, which is dope, but it always worries me. I always remember I had a couple of friends who two girls, in fact, who got jumped in East London after a night out, which is absolutely horrible. They got attacked and all this. But the thing that struck me when I heard the story was, well, it was 3, 4 a.m. and you're walking around a rough areas just because there's a cool little spoken word bar there shit like that. You've got to remember that you're strolling through estates and you're strolling through kind of rough places. And I think that's the problem is I'm fine with the art and beautiful, cool projects and things that come into these areas, as long as you're aware and respectful of what you're
it's just what the weird thing about it is that these, like, it's like the two worlds exist on the same street, but they're completely closed off from each other. Like, you know, and that's the thing that I find odd. It's like brilliant if all this new stuff is coming into an area, but if it's completely ignoring the people who are from there, the people that are never going to go and spend £4 on a coffee in this nice coffee shop, it's just a weird kind of feeling where I don't know, it's been talked about a lot as well, and I don't really want to kind of talk about it now, but thing about that is that you kind of feel like, oh, you know, what's happening? LP says, I wish my home still existed. Do you know what I mean? He's talking about Brooklyn. I'm walking around South London, like Brixton or New Cross or Peckham or whatever, and it's like, wait a minute, what happened here? So I've just fled to Whitstable.
That's wise.
But I don't think the way it is at the minute, like when you're touring a lot and everything, when you come back, like it's, you kind of already feel a bit disconnected, you know,
home,
you already have that weird
home,
detach,
man.
Like
home needs to be home.
Yeah. But I still go down the bird's nest and just like be like, okay, here we are, it's all right, this still exists, we're all right.
So let's go back then. I mean, I was excited about this podcast because I think you're probably the oldest guest I've had on, in the oldest person I know, like person I've known the longest.
Right,
sorry.
Okay, yeah.
So it's kind of nice because I guess we both started this on the spoken word scene around the same time, and I think the South London thing was a good connection there because I instantly feel more comfortable hearing a South London accent because all my family from Lewisham and Peckham and around all them ways. But how did it all start off for you? Because a girl growing up in South London. It doesn't instantly make you think spoken word, a love of literature, a love of poetry. But I guess it does potentially make you think of rap. So what was your kind of...
I just love music. I was just this kind of odd kid, had a bit of a weird time. When I was a young teenager or whatever, I got into a bit of trouble and then I found music. I got a job in this record shop and a lot of my mates were graffiti writers, rappers or whatever, and I was kind of writing. I was always loved to read and write, loved it. But it was always like a private thing, you know. Yeah. It was like my kind of secret
shame.
Thing. Yeah, shame and it's shame, poetry shame. And then I got into hip hop through just being around it and just being in love with the music. And kind of after a few years, you know, I was writing these raps and eventually I kind of told my mate, who was a rapper, that, you know, I've written this rap or whatever. And then so I started rapping and it was amazing and... It was like a really... It taught me a lot about confidence and it just gave me something to completely live for. I got so stuck into it. I just lived and breathed for music. And then, you know, it was kind of before YouTube or... Yeah. We were, like, cutting vinyl still. It was like, showing my age now, but, like... and then the spoken word thing was a bit of an accident. A friend of mine told me about this slam. I think maybe you were even there at the first slam, or maybe you weren't. Joshua was there, Idhin, and Musa was there. It was this like slam at In on the Green. I don't know what it was called. It was like £100 prize.
Yeah.
In Ladbroke Grove, and I went down, and I just told my poem, and which was just a rap without any music.
Yeah.
And suddenly, and I won the prize, and I got offered loads of gigs, and suddenly like. It was like £50 for a 20-minute slot, you know, this kind of thing. Yeah. And like, I was like, what is this? And then just that, I suppose when you're rapping, people who don't like hip-hop immediately switch off. But if you're just saying the words without a beat, no matter what kind of music people are into, they're just watching a person say some words, then they can kind of open up to you. And I just started doing poetry with Apples and Snakes and things like that and did that for a couple of years and then... Suddenly, I was just in this world, that.
It's amazing how quick and easy it is, and people don't realise that. And not easy in a lazy way, but particularly with the spoken word scene. If you go to most spoken word nights, there's going to be people that run other spoken word nights there, or people in the scene and interconnected in some way. Because I kind of scammed it when I came along because I toured about. Outside of London, just doing gigs on street corners and stuff like that. And then I came back and I was doing 3 or 4 or 5 open mics a week. And the thinking there was, and I only did that for like a month or so, or 2 or 3 weeks. And the thinking there was, if you're doing that, then if someone was at one night and goes, oh, there was this, again, it helps when you're at 6'4", you've got a beard and you're wearing a suit and a trucker cap. It's kind of, you
can't miss
it. If someone's like, oh, I saw this guy, and someone says, oh, yeah, I know of him. So it instantly makes people think I'm established and been around for ages when I was just touring around these few small places.
Yeah.
But that scene is so interconnected that you instantly give the illusion of, oh, these people have heard of you, therefore, or seen you live even. That's a bigger thing. They've seen you live, therefore, you must be.
And they're a part of it. But I
and
think
they were
what,
just
like,
open mics. It was free. You just stroll in and
do
it.
A lot of the people that like I became closest to within the scene and everything, none of them had like kind of set out to do spoken word.
It was
they were already writing or they were already doing things and then they kind of found this world, this kind of community of people that were doing it. And I met lots of people who had been doing it for years, like 20 years, you know, like... People like Tim Wells and Selena Godden, obviously, and then Phil Jupitus, who's doing the Porky Poet thing. And so there's that side of it. And then there was like people like Polar Bear,
he was kind of almost ashamed to start doing spoken word. It was kind of, he stumbled into it and didn't intend to. And yeah, it was the same. Me and him, the first gig we did together, we kind of connected because we felt like the ones who weren't really meant to be there.
Yeah,
been kind of letting at any point they're going to go, what you're doing here. Like, particularly those at nights are run by people like Moussa and Josh, who like Moussa's one of my favourite people in the world. I'm going to have him on the podcast. But on first meeting, he's clearly a posh dude. A poe jazzy was in like a cocktail bar in like in West London and stuff like that. So it was like instantly thinking this is we're out of place here. But
it's funny because it's like the variety of things, the variety of places that you get to go and perform in if you're doing like spoken word. Like me and Polar Bear once we had to do this gig and it was in this pub in like not Milton Keynes, that other like what is that place called? Tunbridge Wells. It was like a pub in Tunbridge Wells and it was like the football was on and they'd like just sectioned off like an area of the pub and that was going to be like Poetry Corner or whatever and there's just like loads of people trying to have a drink and like me and Polar Bear rock up this pub in Tunbridge Wells and there's like I don't know like 11 people that have paid their £4 to come and see this poetry night and we were just like what are we going to do like no and then but we ended up just telling poems for like 2 hours. It ended up being like a really fun pretty odd gig, but to you know, you do something like that, and then the next thing you do is in a library and like or whatever, and or you do like school things, or then you have to go, or then you do like a poem in between bands at like a pub or whatever. And I think it's really good actually. It gives you this like this understanding of what people in a space are kind of expecting and how to just like subvert their expectations, how to meet their expectations, and like how to just know what you're on, no matter like how intimidating a place is or how uncomfortable you might feel.
I think it really helps build showmanship in that way because you're slung on in any circumstance all you need is a microphone. So, and I think it's what, I think particularly my early experiences of going to hip-hop gigs, it's what a lot of hip-hop lacked for a long while because it was always just a guy with a mic and his beats and there was no, that's all you ever had, that's all you ever needed. And it's kind of, the spoken word artists I know, I like seeing you perform and a few others, because you've had to go through that, I don't know, the fire there of doing it in a pub when the football's on and then doing it. And even, I think it's extremes as well. I think doing it at what was that night? Farrago or something that was at RADA that was... felt really posh and really like everyone was really educated. That's as much of a scary and weird thing because you're like, right, this isn't the same. This isn't what I know. And it's kind of annoying that you're getting all famous and shit now and everyone knows who you are. Because one of the things I used to love the most was how quick you'd turn the crowd round, because you'd get up there and clearly be a South London girl kind of in your trainers and tracksuit bottoms and, you know, just clearly not, you know, not like where Josh or someone is so booming and hello, it's me, kind of stumbling up and mumbling a bit and be all right.
Shuffling onto stage with a beer.
Always with a beer in hand, shuffling onto stage. But then just starting and people going, oh, shit. And particularly in those scenes where rap stylings were frowned upon a bit, so you had to be good. Like it's one of the things that's trying with Polar Bear as well. We're referencing him so much. We should have him here really. But it was one of them things that it was that feeling of they're already on edge because you're not posh
and you're rapping.
So when you win them over, it means all the more, and it kind of. It gets them on board.
But the same thing happened in hip hop as well. Like, you know, I walk into a cypher or up onto stage at an open mic in like a kind of rap event or whatever. And people, you know, my whole life, people have always been like underestimating me or like misunderstanding what I'm doing there or just looking at me and thinking a certain thing. And then the thing that was always a constant was like, I had this thing that I could do these words. And that was like just my way of like leveling the playing field. Yeah. And like, whether that was like a, you know, a cypher full of kind of big, very hip hop looking dudes or like a kind of posh spoken word thing, or like Charlie Dark invited me down to this, like the opening of the new Louis Vuitton Maison in Bond Street. There's supermodels everywhere and he's got like a bunch of 10 young poets to come and do this fit. Like anywhere. I was always out of place
Charlie
everywhere.
Charlie Dark always has the weirdest hookups in the world. Gigs, he's got the gigs. He's got this bizarre, I don't know how or why. It's just, it's amazing.
It's his vibe.
Just speaking of the early kind of like having to get over that fence in rapping, I remember playing some of your stuff Toronto Example of all people, and him saying, I remember this girl from Cyphers and from Freestyle Battle. So how was that? And is it comparable reward-wise of getting the respect there or getting the respect in... I mean, you've done some posh damn gigs in your life now. Yeah. Now you've been embraced by the theatre world and the literature world and everything else. So what feels more rewarding? Because my instinct would be you'd be more excited for a group of kids in trackies and caps kind of going, oh shit, she's dope, than a room full of well-dressed people going, isn't she marvellous?
How interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all one and the same, really. The thing, when I was younger, I was, you know, desperately, I was obsessed with what I was doing, and I couldn't be in a place where people liked rapping without rapping at people. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't even walk past a group of kids on a street who look like hip hop fans without like literally running up into their circle and being like, yo, no, but I rap, but you know, or like if seeing a kid rapping and like challenging them to fucking battle on the street in Croydon, like it was ridiculous, embarrassing and ridiculous, and luckily I've grown out of it. But like,
I love it.
It's a different time, man. But and then now as I've grown older, like the way that the poetry establishment has kind of in some ways opened its arms. Like some people are still really snobbish about it and don't really think I belong there, but to be working with someone like Don Patterson, who's my editor at Picador, I mean, that for me is like it's a big deal, because for years I had to put my own, I had to put my own poetry books out to start my own publishing company, I had to print my own stuff. The books were always really expensive because I wanted them to look really beautiful, so we had to like spend loads of money, because it was just the whole thing, the whole process of like, you know, bootlegging your own thing and turning up and selling it, and suddenly Picador, who are like, you know, it's a big deal, and they publish poetry, and it's a whole different world of poetry to the world that we know. And to go into that world, I was like, you know, intimidated and everything else. But when I started speaking to Don, and he started teaching me about what a page can do that a stage can't.
Yeah.
And he's going like, you know, you can't perform a semicolon, but on the page it's doing a lot, and like all this kind of stuff. I get a real buzz out of the fact that I'm now a published poet and that my collection exists and it's published by the same people that published, you know, Caroline Duffy or Glyn Maxwell or like Robin Robertson, all these people that I didn't really know about before, but now I'm reading poetry on the page and I'm thinking about myself as a writer and all this kind of stuff. So I still get... But the thing is, what I'm saying is I still feel really blown away that, so, for example, that the album came out and it was well received and obviously we got the Mercury nod, and like having that happen at the same time as having the poetry book come out and, I don't know... I'm still a rapper. I'm still a rapper at heart. I'm still a musician. I've been desperate to make music forever, and for a long time I was making music and it wasn't going very well. So the fact that now the music's out and I'm doing that and I'm pursuing that side of my creativity, but at the same time I'm growing, you know, trying to write a novel, trying to be a writer, trying to be a writer of different kinds of things. It's like
it's all writing, right? It's all writing.
So. But it's mental. I can't even quite explain myself properly because it's such a weird mixture of feelings of like. I still feel like I'm trying to prove myself all the time.
Yeah.
And even as you do more, the more you do, the more you've got left to prove. It's weird.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah. I think it's good. I often end up bringing things back to mixed martial arts or Brazilian jiu-jitsu. But there's a thing in Brazilian jiu-jitsu where it's kind of you should never be. It's never good to be the best person on the mat. It's always good to have someone. Better than you should always be a white belt compared to someone. The thing, if you're drifting in between a world, it's like, right, I'm killing it here, I'm going to continue to kill it here, but if I'm going to do that, I need to have something that I'm the white belt at, I'm the novice at, that I'm learning to keep myself hungry rather than just go, I make albums, I kill it. It's, you know, showing it's always having that thing, always be a white belt at something and kind of. Yeah, I think that's key. But it's fascinating you were saying about the page of poetry, because that's something I've never really written and I've never really read or known much. But it was something a few years ago that my brother kind of really politely said to me, obviously knowing I'm a spoken word artist, saying he's more into page poetry because of the greater width of the parameter, or the less constraints, and the more that you can do, and the things, as you were saying, Ed, the things that you can do on page that you can't do on stage. On stage, there's a lot you can do, but it's still kind of restricted, and it's something I never thought about or knew. For me, it was always, I like doing it on stage because I perform it how it's meant to be, rather than someone else having their own interpretation or reading it in a certain way. I put it across how it's meant to be heard. So how exciting has that been, kind of finding your voice on page, as opposed to, because I think it can become a crutch if you're a good performer, which you are, obviously. If you're a good performer, it can become a crutch because you're like, you can make a decent poem sound amazing by your performance of it, whereas on paper, you've not got any backup there. It is what it is.
Yeah, definitely. Like you can get away with a kind of sloppy line. You can get away with like kind of cliched rhymes. You can do a lot just for repeating something that suddenly makes it sound more powerful than it did the first time. You know, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And when I was working on stuff to be put for this collection, this book, sat down with the editor, you know, delivered the draft, and like it came back and he'd underlined all these things, and like I'd never thought about the content. I know it's a funny thing to hear a poet say, but when you're writing really instinctively and you write it and you perform it, suddenly that's the poem.
Yeah.
Because you said it out loud and it worked, that's the poem now. But when you write it down for the page, you're looking at it and it's like, why is that word there? Like, that's like a really baggy kind of analogy. You don't need that. Like, really, is that where you want to finish this? It should finish six lines earlier. Like, all this, like, it's really rigorous, like, headspace where suddenly I realised that I could just be, like, clearer, more cohesive. It could be better. It could be...
Yeah.
And, like, I'm still such a novice with it. But for me, it's exciting, exactly as you're saying, like about mixed martial arts. And there's always so far to go. And spoken word as a scene is pretty small, and like you can kind of get away with feeling like you're smashing it, you know.
Yeah.
But actually, there's so much more that I want to do with my writing.
And that's it. When you've got your fan base, you can't go back to that day when you didn't have a fan base. So when you've got your fan base, there's a lot that they will allow you to get away with because of their love of your work in general. And I think that's a dangerous
thing.
And then
you become like a caricature of yourself almost. Yeah. You're like, then you're doing Kate Tempest rather than like turning up and you've got this new thing and you want to kind of try something out.
Yeah.
But it's the same with like writing for theatre. I had no idea how to do it. I'm still learning. Same with like the novel. Same with like music. It's like everything I'm trying to write now, I want it to be better than it was yesterday. You know, I want the next thing to be better. And like, it feels good.
So let's talk a bit about the theatre world. We are going to come back round to the music at some point, because that's obviously been one of the biggest things that's been going on. But the theatre thing. And before we get to that, because I feel there'll be a similar reaction and then conquering kind of narrative. One of my favourite moments with you was we were invited to go and do some poetry for, I think it was a BBC thing, and it was above a pub in Camden, and there was Griff Rhys-Jones was hosting it, and you and me were there and having a few drinks, and you'd already had a few on the way, I think. I think you'd had a few on the train or on the bus. And kind of, we're having a drink, and Griff Rhys was being, in my opinion, he felt like he completely disregarded us in particular, because we were more a common sounding. And he had his mate there who was a banker, and he was going to get up and do a poem, because he started writing because he's finding that the banking is so restrictive to him, and he started writing poetry because he loves poetry and all this. And it was one of my favourite moments, because as I said, I felt that we'd kind of been a bit, all right, we've got some people to represent the spoken word scene, and that was about it. And Griff Rhys got up and spoke on a particular poet. I can't think, was it Blake or something? I'm not sure who it was, and he performed a piece, and it was nice enough. And then this banker got up and did a poem about love that I'm not sure if he'd written it then or at school as a 12-year-old, but either way, he'd done this poem. And again, it was all right. I'm not really hating him. But then Kate Tempest, again, shuffled/staggered onto stage with beer in hand. And I was sitting next to Griff Rhys-Jones, and that was the most beautiful thing when you went into, I can't remember if it was Icarus or it was a piece that was, or Prometheus maybe, it was a piece that was drenched in Greek mythology or literature or something, and seeing him sitting there and kind of twitching at every reference that you put through, that half of them I'm not getting because I'm not well-read enough, but him in all this. And it was just a beautiful moment of that. You shouldn't have judged until you'd seen what was going on. And that's what I kind of felt was one of the things I was excited to see, how the your foray into a theatre would go, because I felt it would be a similar thing. It's quite a closed, or it can be quite a closed scene or atmosphere. And yes, so how was that to kind of get to step in? I think the first thing you were writing was more you performing it, or was it straight into writing for other people?
The first thing was the first thing was for other people. It's for three actors. It's a play called Wasted.
Yeah.
And I mean, like I keep saying, with all the things, it was intimidating. I was really kind of afraid of the form and afraid of the whole thing of an audience sitting in a theatre and pretending they're not there, and it all did feel very elitist. Part of the commission is I got loads of tickets to go and see loads of plays. So I went to see loads of plays, and Samuel Beckett, who's a guy that I love, he's a writer that I love. I went to see his play, managed to get a ticket, and it was a matinee. I'd been out the night before, Sound of Rome had a gig. It was obviously, like you say, I used to drink a shitload. I don't drink that much anymore, but I was in a bit of a state, and I'd woken up in the morning and it was late. I was like, shit, I've got to go see this play, and I'd gone, and then I hadn't had a show, I was late, I ran out of the house, I had had vomited, and it was on my shoes, horrible. It was a messy time, messy time. Anyway, I ran into the theatre late, horrible, sit down, looking like a state, And then I just got there in time. I was turning my phone off, and this woman who is posh woman, old, turned around as I was turning my phone off in the theatre and hit me on my leg. Literally hit me. I was, and it's not, it's not, you're not allowed to do that to a person. She fucking turned around and hit me, and I was just sat there okay, this is not my world. This is not, and I felt so infuriated, but I didn't know what to do, because I was just this scruffy, trashy little, I felt like a, but then when the play started, it was my relationship with that play, it was Endgame I was watching, which is a fucking deep play, and it's, I think, really funny but really dark, and I think it's all about his relationship with writing. I took that from it anyway, and I'm there engaging with it, and there all these nice people are kind of politely laughing at the bits where everyone else is laughing, but I'm being moved by lines that I don't think they're even registering. I felt like their play was for me. I come out, and halfway through I think I sneezed or something, or I coughed, and she turned around again, she hit me again. This woman was a bitch. But then by the end of it I was okay, so it was a bit of a baptism by fire, or whatever is what they call it, because I was okay, so I'm, in one sense, I'm getting so much out of literature and this kind of high art stuff. In another sense, I'm being reminded physically that I don't belong here, I'm not allowed here. But the way I enjoy it means I don't care what I have to put up with to be in this room, I want to be in this room. So That's I went into theatre with that mentality of I want people to get a kick out of hearing certain things spoken on stage. And theatre as a discipline is very political. It's it's the only space, really. There's this thing called forum theatre, which I went on to write, which is directly involves the audience. It asks them to kind of come into the room, watch the play, get up on stage, change the course of action. I work with a homeless theatre company for this play that toured hostels and prisons and things like that, where you're asking people to really engage with their own lives and where things went wrong. And it's the only form that cares about its audience that much, theatre. It can change lives. But at the same time, majority of it is really stuffy, really elitist, kind of boring. And when a play's shit, it's it's so shit. But when it's great, when it's amazing, when it cares about you being there, it's the most electrifying thing in the world. So I went on this journey with theatre. I've written three plays now for other actors, for other people's voices, and then one that I perform myself. And the whole time it's been this kind of struggle between knowing that this should be a really open, exciting form, and knowing that also the way people come and watch it is often leave me alone, I just want to be in the audience, and I want you to be the kind of, what do they call it, the third wall or whatever it's called. But I went to see lots of plays, like I say, and I saw this one called Jerusalem by a guy called Jez Butterworth. Mm-hmm. It was the most amazing film I've ever seen. I was in tears. It was like, it was so powerful.
I remember seeing that on in the West End for years and never catching it.
It was so good. Yeah. It was so fucking good, like life-changing, you know? And like life-changing in a way that an album or a film or a novel, you know, they definitely are life-changing, but in a really different way because it was happening right then and it's not going to happen again. It's like, I can't go back to it. I just have that memory of that feeling in that room.
At Stuart Lee on the podcast, we were talking about the that part of live stuff, and he was saying how at Edinburgh, and I had it at Edinburgh, there was a particular show I went and saw two or three times, and he was saying it was that thing, and there's a thing called Slava Snow Show, which I've gone and seen. I go and see it regularly because it's that thing of I'm not going to be able to experience that at some point. At some point, I can't experience that again because it's going to be over. And that's so weird in the world today. In the world today where everything is recorded in some way, so it's just there, it's on your shelf or on your laptop and you've not even paid for it, but it's there to just access.
Yeah.
And that's just a huge buzz when there's something that's that amazing but only exists there and can only and will only ever... Yeah. That's the only place you can experience that.
But like, also, the thing about theatre and doing all that stuff as well, when I got offered the commission and like when I started thinking about trying to write like that, like you were saying about the scripts that you're working on, it's like the jump you've got to make in your head from being somebody who like responds to things they see or things they feel and they write a poem, and it's to then constructing a world, a reality, creating characters, having the characters talk to each other and through that conversation create a feeling that you're trying to express. It's like a whole different discipline. You have to really push yourself to be able to think like that. And then when I got to the end of having written a play, suddenly I'd opened up this whole part of my brain where before I'd written it, every idea I had was a rhyme. That was the only tool I had. So that was every idea was a rhyme. After I wrote the play, I was having an idea and it was like, oh, is that a character? Is that a poem? Is that a rhyme? Is it a song? Is it a scene? And then as I kept writing different things and like, I feel like I've just expanded my capability as a writer, which I never would have done. I never would have if I hadn't been given that chance because someone who was a theatre director saw my work and said, you might be able to do this, and supported me completely through the process. So I think it's important to say that actually, because when people are making work and making whatever work they're doing, if they don't have that kind of push or that support from somebody else, it can be quite rare to believe that you might be able to then push through the initial blocks. But like, I recommend it highly to anybody who's even got an inkling about doing something like writing a play or doing something a bit different to what they normally do. Because when you get through the other side of it, you're like, I could do anything, mate. I could do anything.
So how did you get that support? And how did that... Yeah, where was that? Where did that
come
from?
Because this kind of theatre and spoken word, it's all kind of a bit meshed in, isn't it? There was this night called Nabokov Arts Club.
Yeah.
When there was like music, poetry and... And I'd been down there to do like spoken word stuff. And then the guy that was running it got a job at this theatre company called Payne's Plough, who were like new writing theatre company. They specialise in new writers. He got the job and he just phoned me up and was like, right, okay, I think you could write a play. And he commissioned me, so he gave me some money so I could turn down other work and I could just focus on it. And then he just helped me. He was like, okay, what? He kind of explained to me what a play does, what it needs to do, what a narrative needs to do. And then I went away and wrote the play and I come back and he kind of read through the draft and was like, okay, this isn't working because... And this is working because...
Why. Yeah. That's amazing. It's a great resource to have. And as you kind of said, I think it's one of the most amazing things when you're shown these different areas and disciplines, because as you said, it can make you realise what that idea that you've never been able to quite nail, because all you knew was a rap, for example. It's like this doesn't work. This doesn't work. And realizing it turns out it isn't a rap. It's a different thing. It's still a good idea. It's still a valid thing that you can put across, but it isn't the form in which you're most familiar or most comfortable. So
I was telling stories. That. I was like writing story rhymes. Do you know what I mean? I was like I was writing all that stuff, but it's just a different way of like if it's just a different way of setting your ideas out, a different way of asking your brain to kind of think about things. Yeah. And then that album that we just made, Everybody Down, that I think that's a direct response to everything I learned through doing theatre and thinking about characters. And if I hadn't done all that work, I didn't even really want to do spoken word or theatre. I wanted to be a rapper, but I'm so glad that that didn't work out, that I didn't come out of a rap album when I was 18 and by now be regretting, be Brian Harvey. Have you seen the video?
Yeah, smashing it. This is what I think of you.
I love him, though. I love him. That wasn't a diss in any way. I think he's brilliant.
We put this on an app called Acast, and we can put links into
things to that video
while you're watching. So if you're on the Acast one, you'll be able to look now at the YouTube video. Have you seen both of them, though?
What, the one when he's doing German Whip?
No, there's one where he smashes his golden records or whatever they are. I said, this is what I think of your fucking music industry. And then he did a follow-up one, a tidying up, because he didn't want to leave. And he said, I'm tidying up because I'm a conscientious member of the public. You can still be angry and be tidy. And it's just beautiful after that. There's a second one going, I'm just going to pick this up and
love and that guy, out. Man.
But yeah, no, so let's get on to rap. And we've touched on Everybody Down, but I think we need to build there first, because A Sound of Rum, I think you built a huge fan base with. I think they got across, and it was the fear. I remember when you told me, I've got a band now. Mm. It was like, all right, cool. Because there's in the spoken word scene, I don't know if it's the same now, but it was certainly a time where you get to a certain level and then your next option is adding a band. And that seemed just to be the default, and a band didn't always add anything to it. There was a lot of people, I'm not going to name any names, but there was a lot of people that I'd loved particular poems of theirs as spoken word pieces, and when I saw it in a live band set, it all just blended them into one. It made the uniqueness of their poems just sound the same.
Yeah.
So I was wary, but then I heard Sound of Rum, and it was amazing. I thought it worked. I thought everyone, Archie, and it all worked together, and it built and added to it. So how was that? How did that come about, and how was it for you?
Well, since I was young, since I started rapping, I worked with this producer, Quake Bass, who I'm working with again now, brilliant. But when we were like, as it often happens with childhood friends, we had a falling out, and we stopped working together. And suddenly I was like this, my go-to guy, my music. Yeah. Suddenly it wasn't happening with him. It was like, I was doing poetry, doing all that stuff, and I was like working with different kind of producers, feeling that out. And I was like, I was like, okay, I'm gonna put a different band, I'm gonna put a new band together. I'd had bands before. I had this like ridiculous like 15 piece like shit band that we used to just play hippie festivals. It was terrible, but it was good fun, but it was terrible. Yeah. And then I was putting this new thing together, and Archie was going out with a friend of mine, and she was like, my boyfriend plays bass, you should definitely get him involved. And I was like, yeah, Archie, I know Archie. And then this guy, Ferry, who's the drummer, we'd ended up on stage together at a squat party just playing, and he was like drumming away. And I was like, oh, he's cool, this guy's cool. Yeah. He'd just moved down from Southport to London to like play more drums. And so I was like, okay, let's see what happens, let's put a new band together. And I invited like five other people, my friend who plays vibes, like it was going to be this like, and the only people that turned up were me.
Just such a hippie.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I literally was going to have a vibes player live. And then the only people that turned up to rehearsal were me, Ferry and Archie. And Archie was like, well, I've got this loop pedal, I could play guitar and like play bass at the same time. And it was like, it just worked. We were just there, we had two rehearsals booked in, and then I had a gig at the Tate Modern, and then another gig at a pub for like Ventriloquist's night.
Tung Fu.
And then there was another gig, like another poetry and Rich Mix. Like, and I had these three gigs, and I told them all I'm going to bring a band. So we did this like one rehearsal or two rehearsals. Then the following weekend we did, no, that weekend, that was on a Wednesday or something. Then that weekend we did three gigs, and that was it. We were like, this is brilliant. It felt like really natural and easy.
It's wicked because the three of you had the feel of, and it's evidently what happened, had the feel of the people who would just be up for it.
Just get it
together at a squat party or whatever and just.
We weren't do it like rather dirty than all little squat party. Like, we weren't like, Ferry's very clean. He's like, that's just where, when I say squat, but that was just where we.
But he's a drummer that I feel would happily do a gig if he got there and the kit was like a tom and a bass drum and that was it, and half a snare. Do you know what I mean? He's not someone who's like, well, he can rock, an elite pristine kit, but it feels like
he can rock a triangle if he must.
You give him stuff to hit and he'll make it work and he'll rock it, and that's and yeah.
It was a good feeling, but we played together for like a couple of years. We put an album out on Sunday Best, obviously, as you know. And then...
It's tough to suddenly be thrown into touring life. Obviously, you came on tour and supported us, and I remember at that point, for some reason, it stands out, the Oxford gig. It felt like you guys were close to breaking. I think there'd been the van had broken down or something. There'd been some kind of... that it's that thing of going... And it's what people don't realise. It felt like it'd gone from, I'd be cool to be in a band, and then it was like, right, are you on this tour with us that's 25 dates? Mm. There's one day off every week at the most. You've got to get here, you've got to get there. You're not earning much because, you know, I need to put all the money into beer products. And it's kind of, you've got to be there every night and you've got to deliver every night as well. That's another thing that people don't think about is when you're tired and knackered, there's a crowd sat there. You've got to go out and...
And it's got to be new. You've got to make it new.
Deliver to that crowd and do it properly.
I think, like, we were really passionate. We really enjoyed doing it and we worked really hard. But there was just... There's something to be said for when you're kind of in a band and you also want to do your own thing. So I was it was at the time I got the commission to write the play, and I'm like in the back. We didn't have a van, we had this little car, and we had like, I'd be in the back of the car with like a drum kit in my face, and like we'd have a 6-hour drive to Sunderland to play to four people, which is brilliant. We're up for it, but at the same time, I've got, you know, I'm trying to think about writing a play, which is really exciting, but I don't really know how to do it, and I'm getting stressed out, and the lads are kind of just like kicking a Coke can around in a car park, like, you know, I'm literally in a service station trying to write the final draft of this thing, and like,
it's
it was
crazy.
Just a lot. And so we kind of put it to bed because I just had what Sound of Rum needed was like another 4 years of complete like touring, and
it's a lot of dedication. And I think as much as I love Sound of Rum, I think it was the right choice in the end. At the time, I didn't. I was like, oh, man, that sucks, because it seemed like it was starting to build its name. But I think it's the right thing purely because, and this isn't an insult to Ferry or Archie, Kate Tempest was building a name in numerous areas, so it's hard to then be Sound of Rum, and you can't be Sound of Rum featuring Kate Tempest. But Kate Tempest was a name that was coming up in the spoken word scene, and people were knowing. Or like, I had a lot of people on that tour who had heard of you at stuff we'd done and things like that, but didn't know that Sound of Rum was Kate. Delighted when they got there and found out. They're like, oh, I know this. I know, you know. And I think in a situation that you were in where you're doing so many different things in so many different areas, the one consistent kind of has to be who you are and what your name is, rather. And it sounds a bit selfish to kind of say it's got to be the Kate Tempest show, but it's kind of essential if you're building hype in so many years and you're not able to say, right, as you said, 4 years, the focus is Sound of Rum. It's not the case. You couldn't do that because of all the other things. So if you can't put the focus strictly on the music, at least make the music have the same name and identifier as the theatre or the writing or things like that, you know.
But I think definitely like Sound of Rum was a trio, and Sound of Rum was a different project to what I wanted to do with like my own solo music.
Yeah, completely. And right. I think that's why it worked. I said I was nervous of adding a band. It was seeing that it was like, right, no, this is stuff that couldn't have happened without all three of you.
Yeah,
it's
not
just here's my poems and play something behind it. It's like, no, this is, you know, it's all building off each other and bouncing around and making this amazing thing.
It was a good time. It was really cool. But I'm really happy that since we kind of put the band to bed for a bit, we're not on bad terms. Like Archie's like, we came on tour with us actually like last week. But it's just like, in order to make the music that I ended up making and finish and do Brand New Ancients, which was the next thing I did after Sound of Rum, it was like, when you're in collaborative relationships, if there's any sense that you're kind of holding yourself back in order to kind of contribute to somebody else's creativity or to kind of keep things level, but you really want to, you can feel that you want to be doing something that's a bit more like, you know, different, or there was things that I wanted to say and wanted to do that I just couldn't have done there. And the next thing that happened was Brand New Ancients, which was arguably like the thing that set this whole thing in motion for like things to start becoming more successful and people to start actually taking what I was doing more seriously, because it was like a fucking serious thing.
Assist,
Let's talk about Brand New Ancients. What was the pro? Or what was a Brand New Ancients for people who don't?
Oh my god, it's mental. It was like a 75-minute long poem that I told over a live score. It's better than I just made it sound. It's
was that a backward Giles, right? Was that
So G Quake bass playing drums, and we had cello, violin, had Raven Bush on violin, who's amazing. Cello, violin, tuba. So all the bass was like handled by this girl Jo, who's incredible. And she's like this amazing kind of really normal girl from like, you know, East London. She's like tiny, blonde. She picks up the tuba, she literally disappears behind it.
Yeah.
And it's like just, she's got a couple of pedals going, and just this huge, like majestic, dark bass frequencies amazing. Coming out of this, like just the visual aspect of it. Because it was, we did it in theatres as well. It was like, it was a theatre show.
Yeah.
And the whole point was, oh man, it was an amazing experience. This lady kind of, this lady Nell Catchpole, who's a classical composer really, and worked a lot with Brian Eno with like doing violin parts. Her and the other musicians, we kind of collaborated on this score, and each character had a theme. Each character that I would talk about had a theme in the music. It was like a film in that sense, but it was, there was no like projections or anything like that. It was just me telling a story and then the music telling the story at the same time.
Yeah, wicked.
It was intense though. It was like, there was a lot to go onto stage and know that 75 minutes later I'm going to have just got to the end of this thing. And like,
it's different, man, because we've both been doing gigs and long gigs for ages, but that's a different thing, because that's one,
it's a different thing,
it's one piece. There's not that break of, oh, I can take some applause now, or I can take a moment or chat and interact and,
you just,
and
get you just go.
Shake off any nerves. It's like, right, no, it starts, and then a film later, you're done, you know.
And it was like, I felt the obligation, the responsibility of the audience more than I ever have being on stage doing music or poetry. Like you say, you can stop and chat, and like if something's not going well, you can just be like, right, stop that, do something else.
Yeah.
And the audience come with you because they can see it's what's happening.
Yeah,
but with Brand New Ancients, it was like, it's just this crazy, like, I never felt so, like, under the task at hand. Do you know what I mean? It was like, we did it in New York, and, like, I was on stage and kind of got 10 minutes through it and just felt like I was going to have a panic attack or something. I felt I was going to pass out, because just this huge, like, room. It was, like, black rooms as well, and theatres, and this steep bank of people. And obviously it's in New York, so it was, like, high stakes, and it was, like... And I just, like, it proper took it out of me. Because I'm not an actor, you know, I've not been trained how to deal with the strain I think it puts on you to, like, carry a story.
Yeah.
There's, like, it's quite violent, the story, and there's this, like, horrible moment. And I had to, like, carry that violence into the room and then, like, bring everybody else into it and then bring everybody else out of it. Get to the end of it, I just fucked, like...
Yeah, it's exhausting, right?
But it was amazing. It was, like, such a trip. And, like, obviously it won that prize and...
Yeah.
But, like... I mean, it was amazing. And I got to travel around and do it. But I'm kind of glad... I'm glad I'm not doing it anymore.
I was going to say, it doesn't feel as if you're gagging to write Brand New Ancients 2.
No, I mean, I might write it. But I might get someone else to do
it. Brand Newer Ancients. But yeah, but that did, as I said, as exhausting and killer as that must have been, it did open some doors and did kind of lead to the album you then went to write with Dan Carey. And that's what's kind of sent everything into overdrive. So how was that? Or what was the process? I remember you playing when me, you and Polar Bear did a spoken word tour. I remember you playing some stuff in the van. And the beauty of it being... As much as the excitement of hearing the music was the excitement of seeing how excited you were look at this, guy, this is exactly what I've been wanting to do. So,
so
how was that? And it was a long process as well. Because it was a fair while that we did that tour in like 2011 or 2012 or something, and it came out in 2014, right?
Yeah, took a while. Took a while to get a deal. Took a while to get the right deal.
A great label as well, who are on fire at the moment.
Yeah.
Big Dada just... Yeah, with brilliant. Obviously a label mates, a young fathers, and many others that are just amazing. So,
what was interesting about that is like Dan Carey, because I've known him for ages. Rob the Bank took him down to a Sound of Rum show, and he stood in the audience, and I was like, who is that guy? Like, it's just that guy, just like really intense.
And then he kind of produced the Sound of Rum record, didn't he?
He did a couple of songs with us.
A Robbie being excited to put you all in the room together. And I remember again you coming out of the room and being like, well, like all three of you being like, this guy,
he's amazing. He's like, I mean, I don't want to sound too kind of lovey about it, but he is something special. And you go into his studio and it's just like, it just feels incredible. And especially for people like us who'd like, a studio meant somebody's bedroom with a mattress stuck up to the wall or whatever. Yeah. Suddenly it's like, this guy's got all this gear and it's like instruments from all around the world and it's just him like rocking around. He can pick up anything and make it sound like unbelievable.
Yeah.
Murphy having a little cry to himself. But like he, like for ages I couldn't get in the studio with him because he was too busy, and like we had this idea, we wanted to make a record together, but his manager didn't know who I was, really didn't really think it was worth his time. So he would call me up because like he lives in Streatham,
yeah.
So it's down the road, and he'd call me up and be like, "All right, Kate, I've got 3 hours, you know," and I'd like run over to the studio and we'd like show like yeah. We'd just be like, "Ah!" And the whole energy was this mad, like desperate to work, couldn't ever quite find the time. And eventually, after doing that for like a year, of like little 2 hours here, maybe a Saturday afternoon, and I was thinking about this story, it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then eventually we got 2 weeks, it was like November, just before we went on tour, so whenever that was. And we just fucking smashed it, it just came out, just the whole album just fell out, just like, boom. We just worked like crazy 10-hour days, no lunch, just doing it, like, got to the other side of that, we were like, what have we fucking made? Like, what is this? Like, didn't know who to play it to. Played it to a few people, they loved it. They were like, no way am I signing it.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
that's a scary feeling though, right? When you've made something that feels unique in a way that you're really sure it's good, but you can't be 100% certain because it's so... I remember when I worked with Steve Mason on The Struggle on the solo record, where I went and we did that in one night. I drove 12 hours up to his little place north in Scotland.
Yeah.
And I got there and we were like, oh, let's just jump in the studio for I think we had fish and chips or something. I got there at like 9 o'clock. We had fish and chips. So let's just jump in the studio and have a play about now. And we kind of thought we'll build the ideas and then finish it tomorrow. And we built basically the whole track, then came back to it and recorded it the next day properly. And then I drove home literally that same day.
Oh my gosh.
And I got a text off him. And we were buzzing at the time. And I got a text off him about halfway home just going, is it any good or not? Because it's a weird song about Johnny Depp being a serial killer and it's got weird chanting bits in and it's a weird, kind of bluesy kind of, it's odd. And it was like, no, I'm pretty sure it's good. But it isn't until you get it out there and get it on ears that go, no, it is good. Because, I don't know, unless you've got Kanye confidence, it's kind of, it's that weirdness of... Is it as good as it sounds? So.
Oh man, it is weird, don't it? Like with anything, like you get lost in that moment of like creativity and everything, and you're feeling like it's the best thing in the world, and then
I'm
even
sure
like
this is great.
10 minutes later, you're like, oh my god, like
what is this?
And how it's so weird the way it can just like anything can just switch it on or off. You can go from loving something to hating it to like then being like, no, it's great, and then like, no, I'm never going to write again, and like
it's
mental. But then
right?
it shows you that like, this is what I was thinking the other day as well. Like when you've like done your time with a piece of work and you've been through that with it and then you've decided, no, I've put everything into that, I love this, when it comes out it doesn't matter what people say about it, but when you haven't quite gone through that process with a piece of work and it comes out and you just don't quite know if you gave it your all, then you do care about the praise and you care about when people are damning it, like you care. With Wasted, my first play, I felt a bit like that and I really cared what people thought. With The Sound of Rum record, I felt a bit like that and I really, you know, I really cared. I listened to when people liked it and I really listened when people hated it. But with this album and with Brand New Ancients and with Hold Your Own, the poetry collection, because I've been through so much with making it that it just doesn't, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter now. What
it's
people...
beautiful. I have that. I'm the worst label manager in the world. With the Giacomo Brown album and the War and Peace albums in particular, it was so exciting and I was kind of involved from the start, the concept to the everything, artwork, everything like that, and we were so excited about it. So when it came out and the videos were received well and all this, and you know, the Giacomo Brown album, no one had heard of him and it got a 7 out of 10 in Uncut and things like that, it was all good. But the week after that and now, I still to this day have no idea what the record sales are, what any of the numbers are. I just know it, I just know it was successful because it achieved what we wanted it to be. It was that kind of, and thankfully all of those artists were kind of on the same point. Like everyone gets paid. I've got things in line, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head how many any of them records are sold, because the point was we wanted to create this amazing thing and people to realise it's amazing. And when we put it out and even 10 people go, yeah, that it's is amazing. It was like, we did it. We did it. We're happy with it. They get it.
Yeah.
After that, it was like, I have no idea the other side of it that I'm meant to know. Of
that
we've done
be
these
great,
sales,
though.
We've done this, we've had this peak and all
for
that.
For them, like, for them to be like at a home like that.
Depends on the artist, man. There's a lot of artists who are going to want me to be able to quote stats at them, right?
Yeah, right. Okay, fair enough.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing by any means, But it's, it's exactly that. It's if you've put all that into it, then it's more that that having it in your hand is as important as anything else. Made this that you're proud of and it's there and you love the art, you love the record, you love everything that's gone into it.
When we got the test pressing, when we got the test pressing on vinyl of the record, like, it was just like, it's one of the most surreal and, like, important moments of my life. I was just like, fuck, you know, it's real. And I had that, I had a moment like that the other day as well. I was, like, walking, it was, like, raining, I just got back. I come back from Whitstable to go back to London. I sat in for Giles Peterson the other day, he's on holiday. I'd done, like, a radio show, just playing loads of songs that I like. So, and I was coming back from that, it was late, and I was going to meet my mate, and I was listening to my iPod, it was on shuffle, and a Sound of Rum song, Icarus, come on. Yeah. And I was like, fuck, yeah, like... And then I just connected with this feeling that this has been going on for like over 10 years. I've been writing my rhymes, trying to make music, like, it just landed with me that it's real now, this is happening. Like, you know, we're working on the new record and it's like feeling incredible. And
I honestly think that that's when it happens. Almost that whole cliche of when you stop looking for love is when you'll find it. It's that kind of thing. It's that when you, that when you'd finished this record and you didn't care or what people think of it now because you're so happy with it.
Yeah.
And then you get the Mercury nod. So how was that coming? You know, that was... I guarantee with Sound of Rum, you would have been dying to get that moment or things like that. But it's that kind of thing. When you've done the one that you're truly happy with, it's... That must be even better then, right? That you weren't looking for it, you didn't care particularly, and then that comes through and it's like... Yeah. Damn. They get it.
Suddenly it was like the doors had opened, like this crazy like fortress, which was the music industry, which I've been like smashing on the door of this thing for like years, like being like, oh, can we get a gig? Can we get a better gig? Can we have like a bit of radio play? Excuse me, please, can we? Like, suddenly it was like, that happened. Oh my God, it was just like so surreal and so like humbling and so exciting, like genuinely exciting that night. Like, they asked us to come before they'd announced who the nominees were. They asked us to come and play a gig at the announcement. They'd play a song at the announcement ceremony, and they were like, "This doesn't mean you've got it," you know. I went there to go and play a song at the announcing ceremony, sure that we weren't going to get it.
Yeah.
Like, before that, I hadn't even really considered it was an option. And then, like, we were just sound checking. Nick Mulvey walked into the room. He was also playing, and he was like, "Whoa." And I was like, "Why are you so happy, man? We might not have it." And he was like, no, like, if you're playing here, it anyway. And then they told us, and I was just like bouncing off the walls, you know, just looking at Dan like, fuck. Yeah. And then on the actual night, you know, I got a suit made, you know, got my hair done, everything. We were there at the party, and like the whole thing was just crazy. And then afterwards we had this party, and it was like us, Young Fathers, Nick Mulvey, Anna Calvi, a couple of the Polar Bear guys, a couple of the Jungle guys, and we were all just in this like in this big room just dancing to like, you know, Shaggy, and like, you know, all the cream of the UK music industry just freaking out to like kind of cheesy 90s R&B. But we had the best party ever, and I was looking around the room being like, this is what it feels like to be in this world. Suddenly people are looking at me I'm allowed to be here.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It meant a lot to me seeing that, because I remember when we saw Young Fathers for the first time supporting Run the Jewels, and we hadn't gone together. And literally, I'd heard some of this stuff. I was like, oh, we'll check this support act out. Blew my mind. Yeah. But it was quite London. Everyone was a bit London.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was with my mate, I can't think of who I was with. I was with my mate Mark, and I was like, I need to go outside. And he was like, I want to have a fag. And literally, I was walking out all buzzing and seeing all these cool people. and then I looked over and see you coming out like, I was like, quick, and just going crazy yeah, over how they were, the performance, yeah. the songs. Just, I'd never seen a live act that I didn't know anything of really blow me away so much. So yeah. I was then so excited to see that they were in there as well, and you're on the same label. Do you know what I mean? It felt like that real. I knew that was something that they were an act that you had a lot of a respect for. So for them to very much be your peers, be nominated, be in there with, you know.
Oh man, I love them. I love them so much. It's like embarrassing. I properly think they're brilliant. And when they like, I was sitting there, I was so nervous. It's like they give you this really posh dinner at the Mercury's and everything, yeah. but you obviously you're too nervous, you can't eat a fucking mouthful yeah. of it. You're sitting there like, and there's like all these people everywhere, and then I was just so nervous because like I hadn't. There was all hype. People were like, "Oh, you all before on the red carpet, you have to do all this press and all." Oh, wow. Obviously, they're asking everybody, but you know, what are you going to do if you win? And I wasn't letting myself think about it. I was like, "It can't happen. It might happen." You know, having all this stuff, and then it was like there was this weird kind of animosity that was. The press were kind of making up about Twigs, like me and Twigs. Right. It was like this weird thing, like that. I think Twigs is incredible, you know. I watched her performance and was just like, wow, this woman, like, so forward thinking. And anyway, she's awesome. it got down to the moment of just before, and I was like, everything went really slow. I couldn't breathe. Like, Dan was sitting next to me, and he went, "A little thing called tension." That's just in the like, oh my God. And they were like young fathers, and my heart was just like, oh, like. Because if anybody can deal with the kind of pressure of, you know, winning that thing, it's like they won't let it touch them.
They're not going to, again, I think to the extent that some people will be annoyed that they won't be moved, because they just
don't give a shit.
I had one on the beat down when I had the radio show, and they were just the most kind of, not hard to interview, because it was exciting and, you know, they warmed and everything, but it was also matter of fact. It was just, well, this is just what we do.
Yeah, they're professional, man. They've been doing it a long time.
There was
no
kind of illusion of, yeah, man, we're rock stars. Are we this or we're that? They're just, well, yeah, we just...
I'm just going to pour some water so the viewers don't think that anyone's having a wee.
That's
I'm
good.
Just turning the tap on.
That'd be outrageous if mid-interview someone started weeing.
It's like the Arches with the sound effects.
It is. But yeah, when I was hearing the results come through, obviously I wanted you to win because you're my homie. I was delighted when they did, because I knew that you would be almost as happy about them winning as you would have if you'd won yourself. I think if you'd won yourself, you might have been a bit shitting yourself.
I would have been scared.
Uncomfortable with it. So for me, that felt... personal preference aside, that's the perfect situation mind.
I don't think it could have gone better. Like, yeah, man, it was just such a great thing. And like from that experience, and like, I don't know, just even just having, I didn't really think it would make much of a difference to the way the music was going anyway, because we were getting like nice gigs, and it was but it just gives you a bit of a bit more gravity with like European. This is maybe a bit boring for people to listen to, like little things like when you're booking a European tour or things like that, it just gives you a bit of kudos that I don't know, it's made everything feel a bit more,
it draws people it's in like, and adds that
the
identity.
Plans coming together, do you know what I mean? Everyone seems to be like, oh right, okay.
And it is important, it genuinely is, because I think in Europe and things like that, there's a lot of smaller areas that will look into something or learn about someone because they're coming and playing. We've been waiting you for ages to come to my town. They will see someone's on at the local venue and go, "Oh, who is this?" and look them up. And if you've got that Mercury nod, you've got all this kind of thing, it will make a difference, and it will sway the way they feel about it. So,
how did you find it when you went out to Europe? Like when. So kind of way back in your like first tour after the first album came out, like when people like who don't speak English as a first language are like there and into it and it's singing along, how did that feel for you?
It blew me away, because I felt in a lot of Europe they actually had a greater understanding of some of the songs and lyrics than in the UK, and I realised that was because they don't understand it, as they'll sit down and read the lyrics or translations or whatever and actually read it and take it in, whereas when you do understand it, and this is going to sound really stupid now, but we do something that's talking fast over rhymes in our accent. So if you understand it, there'll be a lot that you'll miss, but you won't really think about, because you get the gist of the story, of the thing. Whereas if you don't understand any of it, they'd sit down and read it and get it word for word, essentially. And
that
blew me away. I was ready for the European gigs to be, and are ready and happy for them to very much be the Dan Lissac show, for it to be about the beats, like we always have still, even though there is that, we did still in Europe always switch out a set to make sure we've got the more up-tempo stuff. And it's more, because again, I've never been one for, you need to appreciate my art. If you paid us to come and play, we want you to have a good night. So it's kind of, if we're having a party, then we're having a party coming. So it's that kind of, if I'm just there to be making noises that sound like words over a beat, you know, essentially to people who haven't got English as their native tongue, then I'm fine with that. And so it was exciting and fascinating for me to suddenly have people coming up and going, oh, this song and this lyric and that. It was like, dude, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's exactly that. That's what's been blowing me away about Europe as well. It's really, I hadn't really thought of it like that. Yeah, that's cool.
That weird, extra understanding. But you've got America on the cards as well, right?
No, man, it's crazy. How excited are you about that? I can't lie.
I mean, equally, because it's the first time you've been over there musically, right?
Yeah.
But equally, have you felt so pressured and put upon with the which one was it?
Brand new ancients.
With Brand New Ancients. Does it feel like a kind of, I'm back, a victory lap almost, a return to, this is what's up now. This is,
Because
you've got your band as well. You've got your band who happen to be made up of some of your favourite people in the world. So you've got this beautiful supporting cast to now return and go, I can enjoy it now.
Yeah.
And again, not that, from what I know, not that anything went bad on your
band. No, we smashed it. It went really great.
But you can go back and actually enjoy it more this time.
Exactly.
It feels like you were there, you did the job that had to be done and killed it, but you get to go back now and go, right, I can actually take this in and go, wow, America's a fucking amazing place.
Yeah, completely.
Despite what the press tells you and the police give the impression of. And there's some amazing stuff in that huge world of a country.
And especially like that, for what I'm doing, it's where hip-hop began, you know, like it's the birthplace of so many of my heroes, and like culturally the amount that I've received and like learned and taken on from America to be going there, it's like when like going to South by Southwest, like you do, like I know that people say, oh, it's, you know, it's too big and da da da, but just like, it's been a dream for so long.
It's bullshit, it's wicked.
Now we're going there.
If you go there, it's too big if you're going there going, right, we're going to be discovered.
Right,
many bands. There's a good chance you're not going to be discovered, but equally, you're going to get to play some cool gigs and there's going to be some fucking amazing gigs on around you. I remember the first year we went and doing, me and Dan, or one of the years we went, me and Dan, doing our shows, but then going to a Rhymesayers showcase and seeing POS and Doomtree and all these other, and Brother Ali, and then being part of the Strange Famous showcase where stood there. I remember, you know, it was Sage, Dolan, Buck 65 all performing. I remember I was walking to stage, and weirdly on that one, Dan had got ill and wasn't there, so I was doing it on my own with just some backing track. But I remember I walk into stage then, and as I'm going up the side, just at the side, they're just chatting and waiting is Idea and Buck 65. And it's just like,
oh my God,
shit, they're just chilling there, and I've got to go out and do my thing now, and then going to come off. And so just all of that, I think it's absolutely amazing.
A long way from Essex, isn't it? It's like a long way from Lewisham.
And again, and literally that, you're doing all of this in a fucking desert, man. It's amazing. It's great to just be in all of that and see this cultural shift. My tip would be, if John Kennedy is out there, try and find him, because he has shit planned out. He's a genius for it. I see, most hardworking man in radio and like the most knowledgeable. Yeah. He'd be out there with a book, we've just planned who he's seeing and when, and where he's seeing half of this act, and then going across the road to see half of this act.
Nice.
And just, he's a beast for it. So he's a good one to have as your tour guide.
Brilliant.
So what's the plan in general? Obviously, it's crazy schedule that you're working now on finishing your novel, but then you're straight on the road for 6 months. So what's kind of, is there a plan of the novel will come after the tour and then the next album will come and then, you know, so is it planned out like that, or is it more just what kind of flows?
It takes ages to turn a novel around because obviously there's so much kind of checking and proofing that needs to be done. So once it's delivered, once the final draft is delivered, it still won't be out till 2016.
Right, yeah, cool.
So I deliver the draft and then go on tour, doing some recording in America as well with some of the producer out there, which is going to be like mental, and that's going to be probably for that album after the album that we're working on now. So that's album three, we're already thinking about, and so that's just mind-blowing. And then it's UK, America, Europe, back to America, then it's festivals, then we get through to the other bit of that. I'll be proofing the novel in the van as we go around and stuff. Then the novel come out 2016, and then the album will come out maybe at the end of this year or the beginning of next, and then and just keep, hopefully, as long as I've got the energy and the ideas, everything else is falling into place where you start to, I'm starting to notice this kind of network of support, you know, this team that...
Yeah, you've got the platforms there now.
They're going to just help me just keep putting stuff out. And as long as I don't, like, freak out or end up making bullshit music or bullshit poetry, then hopefully this can just carry on and that we can just get better and it can be more exciting and, you know, the gigs can get bigger and more exciting and we can finesse what we're trying to do. The other thing that's interesting, I remember talking to you about this, is like having had experience doing poetry and doing theatre, the way you think about a live show is with a bit of a different headspace to someone who might have just played music gigs. So there's things that I want to do for the audience because I know how it feels to be stood in a gig watching a band you love and just feeling like it kind of leaves you cold a little bit, like something isn't quite connecting.
Yeah, completely.
So there's lots of ideas I'm having about how to kind of bring all the things that I've learned from, like we're talking about, telling poems anywhere to anyone, and lots of things I've learned from theatre and how to kind of use a space and a stage and an audience and trying to bring that through to the music stuff and also not leaving the people that like my poetry stuff out at a music gig, you know, because on the tour that we just did, looking out in the crowd and we're there with all our electronic drum kits ready to have a rave and there's a couple of people that, you know, they've obviously heard me telling a bit of poems on like Radio 4 or whatever and they're here to like...
Whoa.
And like part of me is like, oh no, this is a different thing, but then actually I love the fact that they've come to check it out and I don't want them to be feeling like this isn't for them just because there's music with it. So I'm trying to think about how to like bring all the worlds together and have a wicked party and have it being like fucking brilliant and like ravey and everything, but at the same time that the poetry still lands and the words still connect. And do you know what I mean? It's like a lifelong struggle, isn't it?
I mean, it's great because that's exactly it. It is a lifelong struggle, but in a good way. It's continually learning these new tricks and tweaks that you want to add to the show. When I did my Edinburgh Fringe show in 2013, I think it was, doing a show on my own in the same venue and same space 19 nights in a row completely changed how I think of what I'd been doing for 3 or 4 years with Dan or with the live band or whatever, because by the end of that run, it was a show rather than a gig. And I've never had that. And again, like, you've obviously had that with A Brand New Ancients and a new some things, but that blew me away. That was like, right, you know, even... It's really hard to explain. Even though it might feel like a gig, it felt, by that point, I'd got it so tight and I knew exactly how much to give the audience and when to pull it back and when to put the gaps in and all that. And it felt right.
It's a show now,
I can do more of that with the music as well, rather than thinking, let's have a look at the set list. Here's the songs that we're going to play in this order.
Yeah.
It's like, right, no, this is the performance. This is the is the whole thing. And yeah, I think that's an ever-evolving thing. And that was, I said, that was after 500-600 gigs easy. I'd done 500-600 gigs in my career, and it was at that point I went, oh shit, there's a difference. This isn't, you know. So I think that's a great thing that's ever evolving and ever.
And like, you know, when you improving. Watch, if you watch somebody that's really kind of thought about that kind of side of it, I mean, somebody like amazing, like Bjork, and I see, you know, when you see someone like Bjork and like what she's
crazy,
doing,
right?
With
amazing.
Stage and space and like spectacle is like.
Oh, I mean, I bring it back to this regularly, but I went to see the Kate Bush shows.
Yeah, right.
And that was just amazing. It was that exact thing as we were discussing, how it's something that can never exist outside of it. That will never happen again or exist again, because that wasn't a tour. It wasn't a gig. It was the reason it's truly unique. I can't remember if I've said this on the podcast before or just to all my friends and family and loved ones about to hear me say this a million times, but apologies to both sets of people. It's such a unique set of circumstances. The fact that she got huge, toured once, and then didn't gig or do anything music industry-wise for 20 years. Or definitely didn't gig. She did some albums, but still had big gaps. She went off and just... and was a mother and was a family person and lived that role. So to then come back and do these huge run of sold-out, huge shows that had such a theatrical parts going on, huge sets, everything moving. That was, again, it was like... it made me think, and again, it's the same I've had with Bjork. It made me think, the fuck am I doing out there each night? Just strolling out with a bottle of wine in my hand and doing some songs and then going off. It's like, it's mind-blowing that there's so much that you can add and so much that you can do, and particularly for someone like you who's got feet in so many different areas, from theatre to music to literature. I think there's...
I see what happens in 20 years, isn't it?
How much crossover and things there is that come naturally. Again, it has to be natural. It can't be I need to appeal to all the different fan bases, so I'm going to put on a theatre rap show or some shit like that just wouldn't work. It's like, but there will be elements from all of those things that you'll bring in naturally, and it'll be, you'll be doing them for months before you realise, oh shit, I've actually got that from my, more from my theatre experience than from my rap show or music show experience. And
it's interesting that you can't think about, like, if you think about it too much, what you're doing, it's not the same as just like working it out, you know, as you go. Like, none of this was planned. If I'd sat down and made this plan, it'd be a fucking terrible plan. Yeah. You know what I mean? If I'd sat down and been like, oh, I'm gonna do this, and then that's gonna lead to that, and then maybe I'll get into doing that. It's just it's not true. You just gotta fucking do what you love, do what you have to do, what you couldn't not do, and just keep doing it, and just remember that every time an opportunity arises, you've got to just run at it and like try and make it your own.
I just on the drive here, I had my publisher on the music side of things on the phone, kind of asking what the plan is, and it was the exact same thing. I was like, the plan's been is what it's always been, of just to do cool shit.
And
that's about it. Going. That might end up being, I'm not going on stage this year. I might never go on stage again. Who knows? I plan to. But you know what I mean? It's that, depends what, it's just, there's some cool stuff I want to do, and I want to keep doing that. Rather than, as you said, people assume you had some big plan where we're going to do this, and then I'm going to write this play and then work on the album. And it's like, just, it falls into its own calendar, I guess I'm trying to say. Well, we've gone... Way over the hour mark, but I just want to have a little bit extra at the end, because we've not touched on it. It's one of my favourite things that we often have conversations about. What hip-hop, either are you feeling now or made you want to do what you're doing? Because that's something that when me, you and Polar Bear toured, I remember having the realisation that people probably assume that we're spending every day in the van having deep philosophical conversations and changing the course of the future in the back of this small van with Soundman Jim up the front making sound effect noises. And in reality, we would just be going, oh, listen to this track, do you remember this? Just playing hip hop and and talking about rap and stuff like that. So what?
Well, like the big ones that changed my life were, just the really lyrical MCs, probably the same for a lot of people that are a similar age. So It was Wu-Tang, and it was GZA, and it was Lauryn Hill, and it was Big L, and it was Guru, and it was Mos Def and Pharoah Monch. And it was Pharoah Monch particularly was like, and still now is just the king of it.
He's the one, man. He's the king. His album recently, just PTSD. To come back that strong, was just blew me away. And Pharoah was one for me that going to see him live changed everything about him for me as well, because I knew his bigger songs and I knew a few of his tracks, but seeing him just stroll out so casually in a big puffer jacket and then just as soon as he took the mic just owning everything was just one of the most amazing, just instantly just stealing the stage
things. He's the guy. And then like more recently, Jay Electronica, Dirty Goods. There's a girl called Little Sims who I'm loving. I think she's brilliant. And
it's crazy because it feels like there's tons of hype and everything behind her, and I can only find a limited amount of stuff. Like, it seems she still feels insanely new, yeah, but it feels like
she's brilliant. Right? Oh man, who else is like, obviously LP and the Run the Jewels thing with Killer Mike, I think it's incredible. Young Fathers, I think they're astonishing. And then on the kind of lyrical side of it, I also get blown away by like Bob Dylan, Neil Young. Do you know what I mean? And it's the same kind of connection of like, oh my gosh, what did they just say? Like, whoa. But then it's interesting because I just sat in for Giles and did this radio show where I was just playing and just like thinking about what I wanted to play and how I wanted to. And like, you must get it all the time when you were doing your radio show. It's like suddenly you want to play all this hip hop and suddenly you realise how much profanity. Like, I didn't even realise that there was swear words in these songs.
Well, that was the beauty of the beatdown, and it's why I've not really... I had some things... I was meant to be doing a sit-in for Giles as well, but I had some things out of my control kind of stop that. But it would have been really tough because the thing with the beatdown was I played profanity. We were on at midnight on Saturday night. No one gave a fuck. We could kind of, and that's been the beauty of doing the podcast as well. There's no one to tell me off. It's kind of, I just do it myself. So that was a really scary and hard thing to get my head around on the BBC front, was like, I've got a full 3 hours and I can't have,
one swear
all the swears that I love.
And they're so descriptive, so important to the fucking
particularly
music.
Particularly hip-hop. It really killed me on Radio 1 back in the day, hearing when Eminem really blew up. And I love or hate Eminem, he's one of the tightest, most technical writers of all time. But hearing one of his songs on the radio and it being bleeped so much, why are you playing this?
Just don't play this.
And that was my kind of thing on it, if I had got a chance to do the stuff for Giles, which I would have loved to, it would have been amazing. But there would have been too many songs I'd be like, I love this song, but I don't want to play a clean edit of it.
Yeah.
I can get a clean edit, but I don't want to play a clean edit of it. I'd rather play something else. I'd rather play something that can be exactly as it was meant to be, rather than something I love kind of cut down and tied up kind of thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But like, well, I feel it's like an ongoing journey. I'm still finding loads of, like, Jay Electronica is at the minute for me. I just listen to him all the time. I just think he's fantastic. And then like also like Dead Prez, I'm kind of revisiting.
Yeah.
So many, Chester P. Jan Baxter's got this new record out called So We Ate Them Whole.
Right.
I think it's astonishing. I think it's since From the Ashes, which is a Chester P album that I'm like always banging on about. From the Ashes, Chester P is like, I think, what the best album to come out of the kind of UK hip hop scene. It's the most complete and like full and interesting, but it's like nowhere. No one, it's like nobody knows it. I don't know where I even got a copy of it. I can't even remember where I found it, but anyway, that and then this new So We Ate Them Whole, which is produced by Chemo.
Yeah.
It's Jan Baxter record. It's fucking brilliant. It's so good. And I think from that whole High Focus thing, for me, Jan Baxter is the guy. Like, he is...
Yeah.
He's so poetic and, like, psychedelic and, like, forwards and also, like, gentle, and his flow's, like, so... He's got a really interesting flow. Like, he'll just switch it up, like, 3 or 4 times in a 4-minute track. But the flows are all complementary of each other. It's just... I think he's, at the minute, the guy that...
Nice.
I'm really buzzing about...
Well, that's perfect. That's a good point to wrap things up. We're kind of at the 90-minute mark, so that's kind of beautiful. No, that's beautiful. That's all we need. So, yeah. Or where can people keep up with all the things you're doing? I love the fact that while you're in Whitstable, you're kind of off the radar completely, and that's good. That's what I need to do. That's a good creativity kind of tool there, because I love Twitter and Instagram and all of these. They're great promotional tools, but they're also sucks so much time and life out of you. Where can people keep up?
Well, we're about to go off on tour for ages, so we can come see us if you're in the UK or America
February
or Europe.
8th, is it?
8th, I think it's 9th.
the 7th in Portsmouth. Nice.
And then we're doing, like, we're going all over the UK. We're going to go to, it's first time of being to Glasgow and Edinburgh, so if you guys are listening from Scotland, like, please come and see us, because it's first time up there.
Amazing. That's going to be huge.
And then there's like, I've got a mailing list and all that stuff. I'm a bit rubbish on the internet, but like, I do exist there.
You're
so
on Twitter,
come find
right?
me. Yeah, yeah.
And where can they find you? Come on, Kate, help me out here. Jesus.
At Kate Tempest. And then I've got a website as well, and I'm trying to get more into being more active on it. But I'm just like, when the choice is update your online profile or like write a new rhyme.
Yeah.
It's like.
So you're going to be in Portsmouth on February 7th at the Wedgwood Rooms, Bristol on February 8th, Brighton on the 10th, 11th of February is Birmingham, 12th Manchester, 14th Leeds, 15th London, 17th Nottingham, 18th Liverpool, 19th Hull, 23rd Glasgow and 24th Edinburgh. The Bristol one, I posted about these this morning. See, the Bristol one, a lot of people think has sold out. It's been moved up to a bigger room, so you can still get tickets there. So get involved in that and go and see this amazingness.
Loyal Kana, who's another amazing rapper who's coming up and he's brilliant. He's like, he's young and he's so good and he's going to come and support. So he'll be with us for the whole tour.
A lot of the people who have heard of you, of my fan base, it's from supporting us.
And
that's it's so key that people, I mean, to me, it's just the cheap South London side of me is if I'm paying for a concert ticket, I want to get my fucking money's worth. The fact is, people like us, and particularly if you've come up through support slots, really choose their support and want to put someone on that's dope and is going to blow you away. So if you indicate, you should be getting there early.
Yeah, get there early, man.
Your money's worth, man.
And especially, I think we've got a little secret surprise in a couple of them as well. I'm going to ask. Well, wait and see. We'll see. So come and see the show. I think it's going to be really good fun. It's going to be great.
Well, thank you very much, Kate Tempest.
Thanks, Pip. Thanks, all Pip's listeners. Nice one.
Bye.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
That was episode 16. Was it 16 or 17? I can't remember. I said at the start, but I've forgotten now. 17. I wonder if I said 16 at the start. That was Kate Tempest, is what I'm trying to tell you here. I really enjoyed that. It was lovely to see Kate. She seems in a really good place. That was great fun. We're at the end of the podcast, obviously. I wanted to tell you about my club night, We Are Lizards. I've got a club night I've been doing for 3 years now, 3 years of sold-out nights. This month it's at the Book Club in Hoxton in London. It's on Saturday the 28th of February. I'll be DJing. We've got a DJ set from the brand new Heavies, from Push Music, Redshift Rebels, Disco Stew, and DJ Destruction, who is our kind of our secret a weapon that everyone kind of goes crazy for every month. So come down and check us out. I'll be there all night. You can get your name on the guest list by sending your name to info@thetrashsociety.com. But in general, just come on Twitter @ScroobiusPipBio or Instagram @ScroobiusPipBio or Facebook.com/ScroobiusPip for all that information. We Are Lizards at the Book Club, February 28th. Come on down. Next week's guest is Mr. Rufus Hound, actor, comedian, all sorts of stuff. He's wonderful on Twitter. I really enjoy. He's quite a political activist on Twitter. So, yeah, generally great guy. It's really good to sit down and chat with him. So if you can click that subscribe button now. Also, I decided I'm going to start doing these. If you enjoyed this podcast with Kate Tempest. Obviously, podcasts have loads of guests and some you will and won't have heard of. So I thought I'd do more recommends of if you enjoyed this one then and you've not listened to the rest, I'd recommend going and checking out the Killer Mike podcast. We mentioned him in the show. The Sage Francis podcast, the B. Dolan one and the Open Mike Eagle one, all really worth a listen. And last week's Riz Ahmed, actually. So they're just a few tips if you enjoyed this week's one and it's your first time listening to the Distraction Pieces podcast. Other than that, please subscribe and we will see you next Wednesday with Rufus Hound. Bye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.